Welcome to these meditation and philosophy podcasts. I'm Al McGee, and it's Tuesday, December the 9th, 2014. I'm speaking to you from Vancouver in British Columbia, Canada. I sometimes feel so blessed, so fortunate to meet people who, through the what I would call the force of their character and convictions, command my respect and admiration. And what I'd say stands out about them is their determination to be governed and defined by a reverence for truth. And what I've noticed in particular is their characteristic stance or posture towards truth, which is they take a position of humility or a posture of humility under the truth. Therefore, taking such a stance, their first impulse is to learn, not to argue. They seem they're always to be listening. And when they do speak, they continue to listen. Imagine listening while you speak. Well, speaking and listening aren't mutually exclusive, or they needn't be. So people like I'm describing never go on and on, but constantly pause to check on whether understanding has been reached. If not, they're quiet. So I'm describing people who don't stand over the truth, but under it. They don't stand above it, but under it. They don't stand against the truth again, but under it. Those against the truth, you can find that there's a squirming and a struggle that goes on to subvert or avoid it. Or as St. Paul described it, the truth is suppressed where men, it says in the book of Romans, who plainly know what is true, as all men do, regardless of their knowing, they hold it down, like they bury it. They're bent on suppressing truth. They want to keep it from erupting into their awareness, and to ensure that never happens, the truth is held at bay so as not to feel its threatening and disrupting effect on conscience. I get the impression sometimes that some of these have sprinkled themselves with some kind of fairy dust. It's some kind of cover, the nature of which can be a kind of a naive, facile, and ungrounded hopefulness, you know, ever hopeful, but it's kind of like a cover, and they're not facing what's really going on, certainly not like inside themselves. Thus, having been sprayed with this fairy dust, they give the appearance of being kind of slippery. They always appear to be sliding away from truth. Even their bodies might squirm when truth gets too close. Their speech can tend to be garbled, kind of misty and vague, you know, always speaking in generalities, never anything specific or direct. And it's all because of an untethered consciousness, like a disconnection with conscience. So they don't stand with the calm, poise, and dignity of someone whose life is the embodiment of a clean and clear conscience. Rather, because of a condition of being spiritually uncentered, they're always off somewhere to who knows where, some yellow brick road, but not on the road or path towards truth. Thus, their presence can be experienced by some as an absence, and the missing dimension is this, what I'm talking about, a relationship with truth. I mean, it's hard to get any clarity from somebody like this who's holding the truth down, which, of course, is the point of the lives they're leading. They're living in such a way as to avoid a confrontation with truth as best they can. They are here, there, and everywhere, and so hard to pin down. Again, the well-practiced elusiveness is their point, to keep the truth at a safe distance in order not to be affected by it. So I'd like to talk about the awakening into truth and make reference to how during the Battle of Britain, which occurred on July the 10th until October 1940, there were three young American journalists. The most famous of these three is Edward R. Murrow. Then there was Whitelaw Reid and Ben Robertson. Well, they traveled to England to cover the Blitz of London by the Nazis. They sent off, or took off as somewhat innocent and naive human beings. I mean, to some degree. I mean, to some degree, perhaps sprinkled with fairy dust. They were then shocked, absolutely shocked into the full force of reality as the bombs fell and as London was literally set on fire. And in that zone of horror, these young men became aware of what perhaps many of us don't want to acknowledge and certainly don't ever want to experience, which is the presence in the world of the demonic force of absolute evil, unleashed at the time by the Nazis upon the British people. When I watched the film series Finest Hour recently, which, by the way, is an incomparably good film, it's available for free on YouTube, I was astonished by the presence of one of these young journalists, Whitelaw Reid, who was interviewed in 1999, and by then, of course, an elderly gentleman, who was looking back upon his experience as a reporter when he was 26 years old, delivering daily reports from London as the bombs fell. Well, this old man impressed me with his radiant conviction, his clarity, and what was especially refreshing, a tremendous sense of humor. So I watched the segments featuring Whitelaw Reid over and over again, getting to know the man. Upon seeing the atrocity of London burning, Whitelaw had come to the conviction, this graduate, by the way, in sociology of all things from Yale University, that Hitler was an evil that had to be eliminated. Whitelaw's contribution then against Hitler was to write articles and to give talks in the United States on the theme that there are worse things than war. What's worse than going to war is to do nothing against tyranny, in this case, to allow Great Britain to collapse when America had the resources to turn the tide against the Nazis. Whitelaw Reid, therefore, argued against the isolationists and urged the Americans to join in the fight against evil. Well, Whitelaw and the other journalists were then receiving an education in the truth of things, which is hard to face, the full range of the truth of reality, including its dimension of savagery as expressed by the Nazis. Which is how it goes, isn't it? For, you know, character and conviction is something forged in the fiery furnace of experience. It's not a given. It doesn't happen automatically. The possible development of character always seems to take a crisis or a catastrophe of some kind. It always seems to involve some kind of suffering. As the mayor of London, Boris Johnson, asked recently concerning the formation of the soul and the character of Sir Winston Churchill, he asked, "In what smithies did they forge that razor mind and iron will? What the hammer? What the chain?" And quoting from William Blake, "In what furnace was his brain?" It's a great question to ask. In what furnace is your brain being shaped? I mean, what fiery furnace is forming you? Well, the second of the three journalists to wake up into truth was Ben Robertson, who, in the company of his friend Edward R. Murrow, on a high bluff in Dover, experienced a revelation. There, all around him, the Battle of Britain was raging. And Ben wrote in response these powerful words, "At that time, I lost my sense of personal fear because I saw that what happened to me didn't matter. We counted as individuals only as we took our place in the procession of history. It was not we who counted. It was what we stood for that mattered. And I knew for what I was standing. I was for freedom." And then he related how he had discovered St. Matthew's meaning about losing your life in order to find it. He had become willing to lose his life for the sake of freedom. Well, each of these young journalists were mugged by reality and changed their views accordingly. They arrived at what I would say is a certain vision of the human condition, of human nature, as involving the clear discernment of two opposing tendencies within every human being, which is that we human beings have, on the one hand, the potential to be far worse than can be comfortably contemplated. That is, in other words, we are capable of levels of depravity and acts of horror that are absolutely beyond comprehension. And yet, having said that, on the other hand, and at the very same time, what must always be taken into account as well is the potential that each of us has to be greater than has been thought humanly possible. We are capable, according to this view of human nature, of becoming either everlasting horrors or everlasting splendors. Our potential to move in one or the other of these directions is enormous, and therefore our destiny depends entirely on whether we take the high road or the low one, whatever our circumstances may be. So the truth about human nature being expressed here is to take fully into account both man's potential for wickedness and his potential for sainthood. Well, now, I think it's just this kind of vision that I've described here, this kind of vision of human nature, that is either downplayed or dismissed by what I would call a New Age liberal optimism, expressive of a certain shapeless, unfastened, and murky attitude or frame of mind. It's a prevalent and spreading poisonous subjectivism that does not wish to see the starkness of reality and the hard choices that are required of each of us. For the New Age liberal optimists, for this crowd, we're either in or we're approaching some kind of age of Aquarius. The New Age is about to dawn. It's just around the corner. Several more giant circle chants with the Dalai Lama, and we'll be almost there. Isn't everything just getting better everywhere? One of these wide-eyed wonders will exclaim. I think it's kind of a demonstration of naivete, of a dime store optimism. And I think when I hear this kind of statement, wow, you've overdosed again on your medication. Maybe cut it down a little. For these, there is no sense of evil that's not allowed into their consciousness, only the idea that we should always be hopeful, living in a blurry-eyed, Pollyannish fairyland. Now, the effect of this shallow wishfulness is to muddle the mind, as Malcolm Muggeridge observed years ago on the staff of the Manchester Guardian newspaper. He was based in Moscow, 1932. He worked with many such disordered minds at the Guardian, who gave abundant evidence of having been amply, liberally sprinkled with fairy dust. Muggeridge then felt the pressure to write within the confines of their particular vision of reality. We're required, he said, to end everything we wrote on a hopeful note, because liberalism is a hopeful creed. And so, says Muggeridge, however appalling and black the situation that we described, we would always conclude with some sentence like, "It's greatly to be hoped that moderate men of all shades of opinion will draw together, and that wiser counsels may yet prevail." Confesses Muggeridge how many times I gave expression to such useless, childish, empty phrases. In those days, Muggeridge watched with increasing dismay the extraordinary performance of the liberal intelligentsia so thoroughly showered in fairy dust, who in those days flocked to Moscow like pilgrims to Mecca. And they were one and all utterly delighted and excited by what they saw there. Clergymen, Muggeridge says, walked serenely and happily through the anti-God museums. Politicians claimed that no system of society could possibly be more equitable and just. Lawyers admired Soviet justice, and economists praised the Soviet economy. These dazed human beings, including the playwright George Bernard Shaw, were all too willing to believe every lie presented to them by their hero, Joseph Stalin. How could this be, Muggeridge asked, how could this extraordinary credulity exist in the minds of people who were adulated by one and all as the maestros of discernment and judgment? I mean, so-called brightest minds of the age, you know, completely gullible. The explanation, he says, was the refusal of so many of them to see truth because of their predisposition never to see darkness and evil, especially if it conflicted with their utopian fantasies. So these were not minds that were at all enlightened, but were rather frightfully normal, which is always the problem, says British writer Colin Wilson. If you're living a normal life, according to Wilson, you're probably a completely deluded human being. Why? Well, that's because on a daily basis, your habit is frequently to spray yourself with the fairy dust of naive and facile hopes. It's your dreamy optimism that blinds you to truth. Thus, to live a normal, everyday existence, according to Wilson, ensures that you don't understand anything that matters. For as Wilson put it, everyday consciousness is a liar. There is, explains Colin Wilson, a standard of values external to everyday consciousness. That is, an ordinary, everyday, normal level of awareness will fail over and over to discern this standard of values. There's a standard of values external to everyday consciousness, hence the need always to go beyond the limited, normal mind into a state of awareness that sees both the light and the darkness, the goodness and the evil, a level of sharpened awareness that sees and grasps what the ordinary mind doesn't want to see and is apt to miss. Thus, if you're living this normal life, expressed in other words, this usually means that you've succeeded in resigning yourself to commonplace aspirations, which in time inevitably results in a dim-eyed and undiscerning existence. This state of blinding normalcy is well described by T.S. Eliot's character, the psychiatrist Riley, in his play The Cocktail Party, where the practice of most humanoids is described as a blinding toleration of each other. Consequently, as life is lived, for instance, by a couple in such a state of humdrum expectations, they can expect to become, after a while, says Riley, two people who know they do not understand each other, breeding children whom they do not understand, and who will never understand them. I mean, here's the result of normal. And the play's central character, Celia, has lost any interest at all in what is normal, which distinguishes her from almost everybody else at the damn cocktail party. Profoundly disturbed with normal concerns and perceptions, she tells the psychiatrist, Riley, that she's looking for so much more. She says, "You see, I think I really had a vision of something, though I don't know what it is. But I don't want to forget it. I want to live with it. I could do without everything, put up with anything, if I might cherish it." So Celia was searching for a higher life, for a deeper and clearer level of awareness, a loftier vision. She could no longer stand to exist in Plato's cave as her primary habitation. And so it was that, in contrast to Celia's search for clear vision, Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, prior to the Battle of Britain, himself thoroughly showered in fairy dust, traveled to negotiate with Hitler at Munich in the hope that by surrendering Czech democracy to Nazi Germany, that the dictator could be appeased. Well, history has been instructive in showing clearly that Chamberlain, was an undiscerning fool, blinded by a dreamy optimism that was completely unrelated to what was actually going on. He did not see Hitler for what and who he was, an evil that had to be eliminated, eradicated. Indeed, after the Prime Minister's departure, Hitler had a good laugh at how easily Chamberlain had been suckered. Now, Winston Churchill, on the other hand, had always discerned the menace that Hitler was and would be, having had his brain somehow formed through the kind of fiery furnace of personal transformation that Chamberlain had all his life sought to avoid. And it is therefore, as I've been saying, how it goes. Some enter that fiery furnace of transformation, you know, like they do the inner exploration required of their own conscience under the truth, and emerge able to see what others cannot see. They see the heights and depths of the human condition. They're painfully aware of all kinds of possibilities and extremities, and they do not seek to smooth or cover over the stark reality of what is at any given time. Others don't make that journey and thus remain blind. In every generation, some see and some do not. The conclusion reached by the journalist Sir Malcolm Muggeridge is that the clearest seeing and understanding has never come and never will come from the liberal dream or fantasy in any of its manifestations. All you can expect are lies and more fantasy, never reality. But on the other hand, the other side of this, says Muggeridge, are the testimonies to the truth coming from the experiences of the prisoners of the Russian communist gulags. These human beings who had lost their freedom, who had lost everything, and who had seen evil in the ferocity of its full-blown manifestation, directed the attention of the world to deeper and clearer levels of seeing and understanding. Their illumined eyes were, says Muggeridge, like green shoots that will break through the enclosures of cement, that is, break through any expression of totalitarianism. These human beings would not be fooled again by a Stalin or by a Lenin or by the spin on the news from newspapers full of lies. Well, I have this question to ask. Will we, however, be fooled as they were? I mean, are we any different from the masses of people in the 1930s? And I mean the masses of people, including the so-called leading lights, the greatest minds of the time, who refused to see the truth until it was finally so fully in their faces that it could no longer be denied. Are we different? Will we be fooled?